Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm Chris Martinson, your host, and it's June 15th, 2016. And with all that's been going on in the world, and the media's steadfast insistence on showing you irrelevant information, you could be forgiven for missing perhaps the biggest developing story of our times. It's one that could end in the complete destruction of the United States and perhaps world civilization. Now that's a load of hyperbole, right? I'm just engaging in fear baiting, right? Well, what if NATO generally and the US specifically were constantly provoking Russia towards war? And what if that war actually emerged? In fact, it was just Monday of this week, on June 13th, that NATO announced it will deploy 4 multinational battalions to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The justification? Russia's so-called invasion of Ukraine. It's not hyperbole to say that a war with Russia not only could, but almost certainly would, and very badly for all concerned, including the United States. To shine a much-needed bright spotlight on this developing situation, we have with us today Dmitry Orlov. He is one of the very best observers and commentators on the U.S.-Russian situation that I know of. I love his work. Dmitry was born and raised in Leningrad in the former Soviet Union and immigrated to the United States in the mid-70s. So he was an eyewitness to the Soviet collapse over several extended visits to his Russian homeland between the late 80s and mid-90s. And in 2005, he began writing extensively on the subject of the approaching collapse of the United States and the many similarities and differences between the post-American and the post-Soviet experiences. Dmitry argues that the collapse of the U.S., although inevitable, is survivable given the right attitude and some timely preparation. He is the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Experience and American Prospects, written in 2011, and he runs the blog Club Orlov at cluborlov.blogspot.com. I'm quite excited to have Dmitry on the show today because of his unique perspective on the U.S., Russia, and if we have time to explore the crazy circumstances of today's financial system. Welcome, Dmitry.
Great to be with you, Chris.
Well, let's begin with the piece titled A Russian Warning, posted to your site as well as many others and signed by yourself and 7 other prominent people with Russian heritage. It was really a warning to Americans generally and American leadership specifically. Well, what was that warning?
Well, the warning is that the United States is sleepwalking towards a nuclear confrontation with Russia. And it's astounding in its stupidity, this approach, because what's going on really is an effort by the U.S. military and by NATO officials to extract as much money as possible out of Eastern Europe to continue financing weapons and generally extract military spending out of Europe. It doesn't matter what the effect is, they think, because Russia won't respond. And we get to play around and, you know, tear up the soil in these poor Baltic states that don't really matter at all. But the fact is that it could be just one little mistake to trigger a nuclear confrontation. The danger point is very close. And the other thing that they're missing is that the Russians are looking at this, not the government officials, because the government officials take this all in stride and don't think it matters all that much. But the Russian population is beginning to prepare for war. And that is a very serious change. The change in public opinion in Russia is palpable.
Now, let's put this in context for listeners who maybe don't understand what's going on here. Let's imagine that we've put, and this has actually happened, hundreds of troops and armored vehicles in Estonia, right at the border, actually, with Russia. Now, that puts it less than 100 miles from St. Petersburg, second largest city in Russia. Let's contextualize this. This would be like Russia having an equivalent number of hundreds of vehicles and troops in Sag Harbor, Long Island, less than 100 miles from Manhattan. I trust people listening can appreciate that the U.S. might not take a keen view on that. How's Russia interpreting this, do you think?
Well, Russia is has been invaded many, many times throughout its history. And the typical ploy when being invaded is to use the terrain to Russia's advantage, basically to invite the invaders in, invite them a few thousand kilometers in, and then slaughter them. And so the Russians basically are preparing to do that because that's the traditional thing. But since those other invasions, things have changed. History has moved along, and the weapon system now exists so that if Russia were attacked, the United States mainland would be attacked about 30 minutes later, and millions of people would be dead. That's the difference.
As well, that's thinking about conventional or even nuclear, but a kinetic war. And of course, Russia, as well as other countries, we all have different means at our disposal. There could be a cyber warfare. There could be information wars. There's a variety of ways to take down grids, do things. It's a very complex, highly technological society, and there's more than one way to skin this cat, isn't there?
Well, yes, and Russia is no slouch when it comes to electronic warfare. It's quite far ahead of the United States in that. It's quite far ahead in terms of cruise missile technology. The U.S. really doesn't have anything comparable to the caliber that Russians have, which can be launched from small craft or from submarines anywhere and flies thousands of kilometers and hits a target precisely. And it's supersonic, it can't be interrupted. And they have a slew of defensive and offensive weapons coming down out of, basically production lines are running right now that, the United States doesn't have anything comparable.
Now, this is an important point because I think the neocons, and I'd love to get your opinion on those. I know you've got an acerbic and sharp one on them. I do as well, maybe not as well characterized as yours, but the neocons seem to have developed this idea that because we beat up three weaklings in a row on the schoolyard that we can take on anybody. Let's be clear, Iraq was totally devastated militarily by a couple of decades of sanctions. I don't think Panama really counts. Flying over a country like NATO and dropping bombs with aircraft when they had no anti-aircraft. These were all the equivalent of really unfair matches. Do you think that the neocons have accidentally thought that maybe Russia is just a similar, maybe slightly larger adversary, but essentially just as easy?
Well, I think the neocons, they have a very stiff ideology of world domination. Basically, they took over the U.S. government because it's the largest and the most vulnerable democracy in order to realize their insane dreams of world domination. And, it hasn't gone that well, but there's no convincing them. There isn't a feedback loop from experience to what they want to do next. So one defeat causes them to organize for the next defeat without realizing it. So they don't realize that what they've done in the Middle East has been completely counterproductive. They don't realize, for instance, that trying to promote democracy and secular regimes in Islamic countries doesn't produce democracy or secular regimes. What it produces is jihadism and radicalization and things like ISIS. So they can't process that thought because their ideology says democracy is the weapon we use. We used it successfully against the United States. Look what wonderful shape, the U.S. democracy is. It's bought and sold on the open market. And we're going to do that to every country in the world. So there's no stopping them. They're like zombies, until somebody shoots them in the head, they're just going to keep moving.
Well, you made an excellent point in that Russian warning piece, which I thought was around this idea that Russia has this, is refusing to cooperate and just bowing before Washington and thinking of Washington as the sole world leader and that everything has to go Washington's way. Russia has not really towed to that line, of course. Your line in there that I loved was that you talked about the string of policy failures, and your line was this gradual but apparent loss of power and influence has caused the U.S. leadership to become hysterical, and it is but a small step from hysterical to suicidal. America's political leaders need to be placed under suicide watch. I mean, it seems like you've really lost faith that there's anybody sane left in charge here.
Well, I really don't see anybody sane in charge. I mean, it really tells you how much is wrong that really thoughtful people think that Trump is actually, you know, a better choice because at least he has a brain that is, you know, hasn't been taken over by some kind of brain parasite. You know, he thinks for himself.
Yeah, well, I'm among those who go by people's track records, and I have to tell you, Hillary's track record horrifies me as a human, as a non-psychopathic person. What she did in Libya, inexcusable. Honduras, inexcusable, stretching all the way back to when she was a young lawyer, taking on a 12-year-old girl who was a rape victim and casting the girl as some sort of provocateur in the situation. That level of sociopathy has been with that woman her whole life. It's her pattern. I, for one, don't trust that she wouldn't be one of the main neocon standard bearers going forward. And I think, you know, you characterized it well earlier, which is that our democratic system has been so co-opted that somehow we're left with Trump and Hillary as our two choices. That's a pretty heavily damaged system, is how I see it.
I see it that way, too. And such people, people like Hillary, you know, they in a healthy democracy, they would be nowhere near you know, the chief executive. They would just be, you know, relegated to some function, some destructive function somewhere. You know, you're right about her track record.
Well, let's imagine for the moment that she is in charge. The recent polls would suggest that's not an unthinkable proposition unless there's criminal charges along the way that derail that. So assuming she's in charge, how do you think she would deal with Russia, generally Putin specifically?
Well, I don't think that she's actually capable of rational fear because she surrounds herself with sycophants who tell her what she wants to hear. And it's all a question of some kind of strategy for her. So there isn't really the sort of reflexive thought that is required to understand what the situation is. So she could actually just carelessly provoke an incident that then she wouldn't know what to do about. And that moment could arrive very suddenly. So she's just like going through the briefing documents and saying, hey, that's a good idea. Let's execute on that plan, whatever. And they try executing on that plan. And then, oops, they're suddenly in a scenario that they hadn't planned for and don't know what to do. And that would be the most dangerous point of all.
Yeah, my experience with the neocons so far is that they don't understand the concept of oops, or when confronted with a challenge to their power, all they seem to understand is applying more force to the situation. I haven't seen negotiating or learning to be much on their skill set list so far. Kind of a flat learning curve there.
That's right. That's right. They look at everything from the point of view of ideology, and so if something contradicts their ideology, actually looking at the reality of it would cause them psychological trauma of some sort, cognitive dissonance. So they just don't go there.
Right. We do need a degree in psychology, maybe aberrant psychology, I think, to understand much of what's happening today. And that's, I think, why many people tune out. It's just you can't make sense of it. So it's crazy making. So let's not look at it. Now, I want to get into just how dangerous the situation is today. There have been some recent incidents. Before we get there, though, let's set the stage. How far back, Dmitry, do we have to go to understand why we're at such a dangerous situation with Russia? And here's my view. I don't understand it. They should be, like, Russians should have been our best friends. They were heavily down the path of engaging in what we would recognize as Western-style capitalism. You know, they had the rise of oligarchs, things that the Westerners should have all understood. We know how to play ball with people like that at the highest levels. Where did this start going off the rails? I'm confused.
Well, basically, the U.S. and the West in general basically thought that Russia is over when the Soviet Union fell apart. And what they really wanted was for Russians to sort of move aside so that Westerners could go in there and take all the natural resources and, you know, maybe export some of the smarter people and just leave the country to slowly die. Everybody was convinced at some point in time that, you know, the Russians would go extinct within three generations. That was said repeatedly. And that sort of started happening under Yeltsin, who was really a traitor to his people, and things started going downhill very rapidly. The whole country was basically privatized by a bunch of criminals under Yeltsin. He just basically handed out huge parts of the country to his friends. But then things started going very badly, and I think he had some recognition of the fact, which is why this very strange thing happened, and he resigned and put Putin in his place. And Putin turned out to be a very surprising man, extremely capable, and nobody could have predicted what he would do, but what he basically did was resurrect the country. And so now Russia's demographic problems are solved. Life expectancy is highest it's ever been. It's over 70%. And the economy has doubled several times since he became the leader. People are generally quite happy, but there is this recognition that they've run afoul of these Westerners who now are pushing towards a war. So the Russians are preparing to fight another war.
Now, I wonder if that, the way you phrase that makes me think of Libya, and here's why. Before Gaddafi took over, Libya was the poorest nation on the planet. And by the time he was taken out by a NATO military action, Libya had the highest standard of living in all of Africa and had a higher living standard than Russia, than Brazil, other places. But he had some cardinal sins under his belt. Not that he was a strong man. You need that in a fractured tribal area. But what he did was he kept all Western banks out. No Western companies were allowed to go after the Libyan oil. He took the oil proceeds. If you got married in Libya, you started out with a $49,500 one-time gift from the government to start yourself. Mortgages were limited to 10% of your salary for 20 years. That's how you would get your house. If you had a medical issue that couldn't be taken care of for free in the country, they would pay for you and one other person to fly anywhere in the world and receive that treatment. He really took his oil wealth and spent it on his people. To me, that was the cardinal sin. So it's almost like the West says, listen, if you won't let us come in and take your stuff for ourselves, we're going to demonize you. And if we have to, we'll take you out.
Well, yes, but, you know, there's a big difference, which is, you know, this what you said is absolutely true. And you know, Russia is not quite so lavish as Libya. But on the other hand, Russia is not Libya because it has all sorts of things other than oil going on. It's a very highly developed society that produces a lot of stuff. And also in terms of its role in the world, yes, Libya had a role in Africa. It was a regional power. It put up communications satellites that all Africans could use. It brokered a peace process throughout Africa. But it was a regional power. Russia is, you know, a global power that can project force anywhere in the world. So, you know, this is, somebody could pick a fight with Libya. There was nothing that Libya could do. Nobody can pick a fight with Russia and expect to survive, really. That's what it comes down to. That's what makes Americans so utterly delusional.
Well, let's talk about that delusion for a second, because I when I read about Putin and Russia in the U.S. press, it's very easy to read the talking points. Somebody went on a big marketing campaign about a year ago to talk about Russia being isolated, Putin, you know, losing favor. But whenever I read translated internal documents from Russia, it appears to me that Putin's quite popular, and that far from being isolated, all that's happened is they've realigned who Russia will do business with. And that all seems to be not going the same as the propaganda would have us believe. What is the situation inside Russia in terms of Putin's popularity, and just how isolated are they really?
Well, in terms of being isolated, that just never rang true at any point in time. There's really no evidence at all that Russia has been isolated. It's becoming the most important broker in the Middle East right now. It's replacing the United States as the security guarantee of Israel. Basically, the United States is out of there. The United States is out of the Middle East. There's nothing more they can do except maybe cause a little more damage. And Israel needs a new friend, and so that's Russia. And you know, so that's a big recarving of the world right there, and how isolating that is that. And then there's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that is humming along. There's a huge amount of work partnership with China. There's lots of work going on with India. There are lots of trade relationships throughout the world. So all of that international trade is booming. And also there's a political dimension to it, which is Russia is the one country that has basically said, we will stand up to the United States. We will not accept American leadership. And you wouldn't believe how many countries around the world are cheering that and want to jump on that bandwagon.
Now, I'm not reading about any of those countries in my newspapers.
Oh, well, you can't read any of that in the media in the United States. That's just an echo chamber that reverberates with fictional stories.
Now, I'll tell you some stories that should have reverberated, which was, this actually started a while ago. And so I was watching carefully and reading your great material around what was going on in Ukraine. Obviously, there was some great disinformation in the West about what really happened there. But it was in the context of that that I noticed, like, my hair stood up on end when I saw that Russia tested every single nuclear system in 2014, put all the successful launches on YouTube. I mean, they did everything from ground artillery to ICBM launches from silos, mobile missile launchers, airplane launches. Every system was tested. And the second was that they conducted the largest nuclear readiness drills ever in history in 2015. Some 10,000 nuclear specialists went through all the drills. To me, they were clearly saying, hey, we're ready. Our stuff still works. If you thought it rusted during all that uncomfortable period, it didn't. And somehow those barely garnered any media attention over here.
Well, yeah, there's that. There's also the fact that now in Russia, a military drill can be called without warning at any time, and everything better work. So basically, the entire military is at a high state of readiness. The US media also missed the fact that what the Russians did in Syria with a really, really small contingent is something that the US couldn't possibly have done, and NATO couldn't possibly have done. If you look at the number of sorties and the number of strikes per unit time, which is basically, ground crews working seamlessly with pilots on rotation, jets landing, getting refueled, getting reloaded, taking off continuously. That is not something that, the US is capable of at this point. So this is a different military. This is not the US military. This is something completely different. And then, there wasn't really much reporting about the new weapons that Russia has. They have the S-300, S-400. Now they're rolling out the S-500, which will be able to hit targets in near space. And that will basically be like a giant impenetrable shield over most of Russia, including all of the ballistic weapons that the U.S. has. And they also didn't really report on the supersonic torpedoes and cruise missiles that Russia has developed. Because, they don't really mention the fact that the Russian nuclear subs lurking all along the western and eastern seaboards all the time, on patrol, armed with these Kaliber supersonic cruise missiles that the U.S. has absolutely nothing to detect them or to shoot them down. And they can be nuclear tipped. So all of that is just not being talked about. Everybody is still thinking, oh, Russia, it's weak. But it's aggressive. Both of those are not facts.
She's strong, and she will respond, of course, if she needs to. And that NATO encirclement, which began, back in 89 with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the relentless expansion of NATO, that really actually happened under Bill Clinton, didn't it, mostly?
Well, yes. Bill Clinton is the, under George Sr., George Bush Sr., there were some neocons in the White House, but he called them the crazies in the basement. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really let them do much. It was a mistake to keep them there at all. But under Bill Clinton, because, you know, Clinton, what did he know about foreign policy? He just basically invited them into the Oval Office, and they've been there ever since. So that is really what holds the U.S. Foreign policy together. And because these people are, you know, insane, that is what is causing a continuous series of foreign policies fiascos that is basically, you know, freezing the United States out of any participation in anything constructive going on internationally.
Yeah. You know, on that point you made before about the readiness of Russia, it was just yesterday on June 14th that a surprise combat readiness inspection of the command and control organizations and arsenals of the Russian armed forces was announced. That was on Tuesday. The Russian Defense Ministry reported. So let's see, that they informed the commanders of the Eastern, Central, Southern, and Western military districts. I guess that's everything but the Northern, that they were going to have these surprise inspections, which were there to show combat readiness and condition objectives. That to me sounds like a high state of alert. Those are expensive sort of operations to run, and it's expensive to keep your military basically gassed up and on the runway. It sounds like Russia is ready.
Russia is ready. And what's even more scary is that the Russian people are ready. So there are all these groups all over Russia that do stunts, like they run marathons off-road. And the marathon sometimes includes some tactical objectives too. So this is like paramilitary training for lots and lots of young people in the country. And some of them don't even like the government that much, but that doesn't mean that they won't take orders if orders are given. And you know, if there isn't a nuclear confrontation, and NATO rolls into Russian territory, you know, they will bleed, and they will bleed to death, just like it's always happened in people who invaded Russia. So there isn't really like a happy outcome. There isn't a face-saving outcome for the United States or for NATO. There is just basically the choices between death and humiliation.
Yeah, well, we'll take death over humiliation every time when it comes to these people in charge, I guess. Now, I want to get to the incidents that have captured my attention and made me nervous. Yes, there's readiness drills, and there's showing that nuclear systems work and posting all that to YouTube. But recently, the U.S. had a guided missile destroyer in the Black Sea, had a series of flyovers from Russian jets as well. The USS Donald Cook in the Baltic Sea recently just had flyover incidents. Kerry even said, hey, rules of engagement said we could have shot those planes down if we wanted to, even though they were unarmed at the time, just showing sort of a display. It's showing that first, there's increasing irritation between the two parties here. This is, you know, the tensions are ratcheting up. And second, that the chance of an accident happening, the kind of accident or incident you talked about before, where, you know, all of a sudden there's an incident report on the president's desk and they have to respond to it. What do they do? The chance of an incident seems pretty high now when we've got these, you know, flyovers that are happening within meters, several tens of meters, or sometimes, you know, less than that. It seems to me anyway, like the chance of an incident is pretty good.
Yes, it's unfortunate that, you know, that such carelessness is, you know, being provoked. But basically, if you are if you want to move your military vessel right next to the territorial waters of a sovereign nation, you generally have to contact that nation and tell them what you're doing. And also, there should be a transponder on your vessel so that everybody knows who they are. And the Americans haven't bothered to do that, which is why there are these flyovers. The Russians go out and they go out and they identify the vessel. Same thing with these spy planes that have been encroaching on Russia's borders. The Russians fly and identify them and accompany them. So this is perfectly normal behavior, but what's provoking it is the refusal of the Americans to cooperate.
Now, let's talk about how Russia and China seem to be cooperating more and more. China also making increasingly unhappy military statements, mostly around, I guess, the South China Sea, Spratly Island areas. But more generally, just unhappy. The United States is also over there in the Pacific theater. engaging in the similar activities, which is just flexing muscles, saying, hey, we're here, we'll do what we want to do. Is in your mind and in your experience, what is developing between China and Russia? Are they starting to feel like they're on the same side of something at this point?
Yes, there isn't really a whole lot of distance between them, psychologically or in terms of overall understanding and policy. Basically, they understand that the world has become sort of bipolar, with the United States, this ever shrinking one half of it, and China as Russia, the ever expanding other half of it. And they want to finesse this process. They want to just basically wait it out. They want to wait the United States out, without provoking a major confrontation. But they're doing it together.
Well, let's say they read your five stages of collapse, just a brilliant piece of observation, synthesis, and writing. Where do you peg the U.S. on that collapse continuum? And do you think, you know, China and Russia are sort of watching whatever continuum they're looking at and noting that the United States has a lot of rope and might hang itself someday?
Well, when I wrote the book, I thought of a rapid process, but if you have something as huge as the United States, there's quite a bit of a buffer. There's the opportunity to manipulate the situation and deploy all sorts of delaying tactics, which is what we've been seeing in the area of finance. Mm-hmm. It's just basically taking a really long time for the shoe to drop. Like, the conclusion is written on the wall in neon letters, but it's, we haven't reached that point yet. So, yeah, okay. So, you can look at, macro stuff like, okay, interest rates are below zero now. The balance sheet of the Fed is pegged out. It stopped growing. It hasn't grown for a year and a half now. And they've basically, they have no more knobs to operate at all. All of these bonds, there's been like this gigantic bond bubble that's lasted decades. The bond yields are going negative. You know, there's this, magic disappearing money that we have. And then you can look at all the statistics that are being faked. But if you realize that they're faked and look a little behind it, you realize that basically, the economy is shrinking. The real economy of goods and services is shrinking, non-financial services. This place isn't long for, a few stages, the first three stages. In terms of politics, you can't look at this, election cycle and say, oh yeah, things are healthy. This is what democracy looks like. I don't think anybody in their right mind would say that. And if you look at where the place is in terms of social and cultural collapse, well, some places are actually fairly healthy and have gotten better. But there are huge parts of the country that are just completely devastated, especially closer to the middle of the country, just socially and culturally, just completely hollowed out and devastated. So, it may take a while yet for events to unfold here, but the first three stages of financial, commercial, and political collapse, we can sort of see the early signs of each one.
Yeah, it's, I think, becoming more apparent to more people, and certainly the all-important class of younger people, who many of whom were more solidly in the Bernie camp, watching an entire election just flagrantly stolen, just with every trick in the book, but they didn't even apologize for it or really do a good job hiding it. It was a blatant episode after episode of raw theft. And for people who have even the slightest math training, understanding statistically how impossible, well, I'd say improbable to make it soft, but it's really impossible results happened, those really get to the next stage of that cultural slash societal collapse. I mean, the glue that holds us together is if you can't believe in your justice system, if you can't believe in the words you read in the newspaper, if you can't believe in the systems that you're being asked to tax into and maybe even bleed and die for, that's corrosive. That's something, Dimitri, I think that's missing in our leadership, is they don't understand just how corrosive what they're doing is. And it's not just corrosive to the little people under them, but to the whole edifice It's almost like they're unable to comprehend really what they're up to, but yet they keep doing it.
They are unable to comprehend. Imagine when you look at yourself in the bathroom mirror, your basic working assumption is that what you're seeing is what other people see when they look at you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case anymore. So in the US, there's maybe 50, 60% of the people who just like walk around making animal noises, that they don't really have an opinion. If they have one, it doesn't matter. Okay, then there's maybe, 40, 50% of the people who actually pay attention, think about it, get worked up about various things. And the question is, where do they get their information? They don't get it from the television or the newspapers anymore. They get it from the internet. They get mm-hmm. it through social media. They get it through their online friends. And that has become relatively impenetrable for, well, not so much impenetrable. It's just that the effects are the wrong ones. So there's this basic propaganda onslaught that is ongoing to limit what people know, especially about the outside world, to propagate the single coordinated corporate message so that everybody's brains are aligned. And that's not working. That doesn't work anymore. So they've lost control. So they think that they look at the television, they see their image on it, they think that that's what everybody's looking at, but that's not what everybody's looking at.
Hmm. Yeah, that echo chamber's pretty profound at this point in time. And this election cycle has clearly shown that to a lot more people, and that's a good thing. So before we turn entirely away from this side, let's armchair this for a second. Okay, so let's say a kinetic war does break out with Russia. You mentioned the caliber missiles and subs off the coast and all this, but if missiles and bullets and things really start flying back and forth, what are the risks here, really? I mean, the United States has been immune from really any substantial damage except for Pearl Harbor, and that's debatable as to whether we could have stopped that. So at any rate, what's really at risk here?
At risk here is the inability to stop the progression to nuclear annihilation. So, let's say, NATO invades Russia under whatever pretext, right? And gets horrendously bloodied, and gets desperate and lobs a missile at one city in Russia and blows it up. And the US proportionally responds and blows up, I don't know, Chicago, and says, okay, now are you ready to sue for peace, or should we destroy a few more cities on your side? Because we don't have to stop. So the question is, at that point, do the Americans realize that they've lost? Like, Chicago is very important. Okay, Estonia is not very important. Can the Americans process that calculus in their heads?
Well, not rationally?
No, yes, rationally.
No, it'd be impossible to calculate that rationally. We'd be apoplectic. We'd be out of our minds.
Okay, well, you're apoplectic. Do you want to lose Los Angeles and Dallas tomorrow, or do you want to remain apoplectic?
Well, I can only imagine that the civilian side, the neocon side, would be just wanting to push every button that said fire on it that they could. I can only hope, my only hope in that moment is that I talk to a lot of military people, and they're very rational folks, and they can perform calculations, and they understand risk profiles. So my only hope is that there would be a general failure to follow orders in that circumstance.
Well, the orders have to sort of filter through, so it really hinges on whoever makes the ultimate decision. And the biggest danger there is that, if you have this kind of functionary who goes by briefing documents and signs off on things, she'll sign off on whatever the crazies tell her to do.
Yep.
That's the danger.
Yep. So to me, I got into a fairly decent sized argument with a gentleman on my site, former sub guy, very highly placed there. And he was of the mind that whatever Russia had, we had defenses against it, and there were a lot of tricks that we could put. My main point was that ships, as modern as they might be today, are just large steel boxes looking for a reason to sink. I actually think the Exocet missile in 83 on the Falklands taught us that the cost of defending a ship is impossibly expensive against the cost of developing a missile system that could overwhelm. Like, even if you've got like these great phalanx guns and you've got these, you know, cute little missiles on board, there's only so many of those rounds that can be used in defense. And so if there's a swarm of incoming, you know, some are going to get through, period. And that's just the nature of it all. The United States has not been bloodied in warfare like that in a long time. I honestly don't know how we would react here in this country at the political level, at the decision level, not the people on the street, as you mentioned, largely irrelevant to the process. I don't know how we'd react. I really don't. That's an open question. So given that, if you, well, you're you, how are you preparing yourself in whatever dimension, mentally, emotionally, physically, materially? How are you preparing given the risks you see?
Well, my family is in Russia. I'm still in the United States, and I'll be going over to Russia probably. You know, they'll come over back here. We'll spend the winter here, and then in the spring we'll probably go to Russia. We have a country house there. There's adjoining farmland that I'm interested in. It's actually it's along the Baltic border, so it's kind of like if you think about a dangerous place to be, I guess, but less dangerous than being in this country. And because the place is, you know, basically designed to survive, which I can't say about the United States. So yeah, I mean, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to Russia.
You are. Well, that's fascinating. All right. Well, I see, you know, we've spent a good amount of time on Russia, and if you have more time, I would like to turn now to the craziness in the financial system, because you had a fascinating piece on the interest rates, which you just touched on briefly, then the fact that we've gone to zero and increasingly negative rates. I love that you tied in my favorite, of course, approach is that we can't understand interest rates and growth and all of that stuff outside of the context of resources. We've clearly hit a limit to growth just economically. Debt has grown to a point where it all on its own, debt becomes counterproductive, irrespective of your external resource situation. But let's be clear, oil is not something that you can just go and get out of the ground for an equivalent of $10 a barrel today. You can get more, but you got to spend 80 or more. And on down this long list of resources, I think that's part of the story. It's the debt saturation that's part of the story. It's the fact that exponential money systems tend to accumulate preferentially to a smaller and smaller crew of elites. That's part of the story. There's a lot of things impinging on this story. I'd love to talk to you about negative interest rates, because to me, those are as much, we have to understand those psychologically, even more than we need to understand them financially. Well, first of all, we don't have any history to go on to say, oh, that's how it worked out last time. So we're in new territory. But to me, the psychological dimension of having your system of money go into negative territory, I look at that and say it exposes it as a fraud to an increasingly large and important set of people out there. But you had another take on it. Talk to me about negative interest rates, because I still don't really understand them.
Well, basically, there's a money creation process. You know, bankers do their little mumbo jumbo ritual, and money springs forth out of nothing. But it's very important that it doesn't spontaneously disappear again, which is what happens when somebody defaults on a loan. You have to basically, you know, write it off, a write down. And people hate doing that because, you know, there are layers of leverage throughout the system. So if you knock out a piece, it's like one of those Jenga games, you know, you knock out a piece and a whole bunch of other pieces tumble. So they hate it when that happens. They want to make sure that debt, huge amounts of debt, don't go bad, especially not all at once. But the problem becomes that, you know, as growth stalls, it becomes more and more difficult to repay debt. So then you have to say, well, never mind about repaying debt. We'll just drop the interest rate to zero so you can just keep that debt, okay? There isn't even an interest you have to pay for it. But then those people start basically, you know, going even more broke, where, you know, everybody's got to eat, and people who have lots of debt have to eat too. You don't want them starving to death, because then what happens to the debt? So you have to pay them to hold on to that debt, and that's the negative interest rate. But either way, you know, it's sort of the difference between spontaneous demolition, which is everybody defaults, or controlled demolition, where negative interest rates just eat away at the money until it's all gone. But the whole thing is that you want, they've been lowering the interest rate forever, for decades now. Now it's been stuck at zero for a while. And now if you look at it, this morning I saw that 16% of bonds, euro bonds, have gone negative. Japan is negative all over the place. So, and that's going to accelerate. So it's going to be a little bit negative and then a little bit more negative. And then money will start disappearing faster and faster. That's the logic of it. If, in order to allow people to continue rolling over their debt, the interest rate has to continue dropping forever. And so that's the predicament. That's the incredible money disappearing act that's unfolding before our very eyes.
It's an astonishing thing. So if you have access to that, what a money machine, right? So I could get you to give me $1 billion and I'm only going to give you, you know, that minus a percent back or whatever the numbers turn into. And I could actually set all that money aside right this second and just take the 1% for myself in this moment have the rest squirreled away in a way I could just sort of funnel it back to you. I'll do that all day long. This is a money minting machine for people who are on the front end of that. To be paid to hold money for somebody is an astonishing thing, particularly if you're in government. So, but the unintended consequences of all this have been in Japan, where they've been playing around with this longest. They're like, hey, wait a minute, this is actually causing people to fret about the future more, not be more wildly animalistic in their consumptive patterns. It's causing people to be more fearful about not having money instead of less, so they're actually saving more. It's actually not working out even remotely as intended, and yet we're doing more of it. Of course, that's how we do things in this modern world. Something doesn't work, we just need to do more of it. It's sort of a Krugman approach. Isn't it becoming really obvious that negative interest rates aren't doing it at this point? Don't you think they must be noticing the data?
Well, they will try to ignore the data, because what choices do they have? It's sort of like, you know, there's nothing else they can do. I mean, the big problem with negative interest rates is that once you have negative interest rates, what you're talking about isn't exactly money. It's something, right? But it's not money in the normal sense that people are used to thinking of money as. You know, the old adage is, you have to have money to make money. Well, now it's you have to have money to lose money. Well, you know, you can lose money any way you like. You know, that's not a specialty skill. That's not like, that's not very important to know how to lose money. Anybody can lose money. And so the question becomes, well, what do you do with this stuff that isn't exactly money? And the answer is, figure out what is more money like. So, you know, land is more like money. That's why real estate is called real. That's the only sort of real wealth there is land. So people will start putting money into land holdings, bid up the price of land. That will have insidious consequences. Or they'll bid up the prices of precious metals and other things that could serve as stores of value. Certain European banks are stockpiling freshly minted euros in vaults, because that's better than keeping money on deposit at negative rates of interest. So there are all these things that happen that are basically erosions of the idea of money, because once you have negative interest rates, money is no longer money.
So this is really we're out of the realm of finances and we're into the realm of voodoo at this point in time. I mean, money is an idea. We pretend it's real, but it's an idea. It's something we imagine has value, and so it does. And we create structures around that to pretend it has value, and things like taxes and other stuff like that. That's all good, well and good. What you're talking about is that the very foundational idea of money that we've all built all our systems and thinking around is really under attack with this latest wave, and all of that in service to try and keep and perpetuate an unsustainable system going a little bit longer. Hey, we were borrowing at twice the rate of our underlying income. Bad idea. Let's not talk about that. Let's just keep that going a little longer. Maybe cross our fingers, the gods of growth smile kindly on us. They've been missing in action for well over a decade, and yet we persist. So in my mind, we persist until something just breaks and people need to be ready for that. Do you share that view? Last question. And if so, how should people get ready for that?
Well, basically, you know, if you see the very concept of money as the perfectly abstract and universal medium of exchange and store of value, if you see it failing doing that, then you're back to basically barter arrangements. So get good at that. Understand that barter is really, you know, the basis of it, that any kind of a, when you buy something with money, you're just bartering money for something. And if money is as weak as it's going to become and as conceptually undermined, then you might consider bartering something else.
All right, bartering, absolutely great skill to have. We've been talking with Dmitry Orlov. He runs the ever popular and wonderful site at Club Orlov. You can find that at Club Orlov, that's O-R-L-O-V, cluborlov.blogspot.com. I would encourage you to go there, read A Russian Warning, very well written. We didn't get to all the excellent points in there. Super piece of writing and wake-up call for people. So with that, Dmitry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Chris.